Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome you here to celebrate poetry and the poetry of Lee Young Lee. My name is Kenneth Clark, and I am the director of the Poetry Center. Thank you, Richard. The Poetry Center was established in 1973 by a team of Chicago poets, and through its annual reading series, this is one of those events, has presented hundreds of poets to the people of Chicago. The Poetry Center's board of directors and staff are happy to offer you this evening's events, as well as others coming up in the spring during April and May. Pick up a brochure, make sure you don't miss anything. And also be sure to pick up a hands-on stanzas brochure. It's a wonderful program that pays Chicago poets to be in residence in Chicago public schools to teach kids how to read and write poetry with the subversive and amazing results of teaching them how to read and write better. So we have 25 poet residencies reaching about 5,000 kids directly. Is that right? It's 2,500 kids directly and about 14,000 kids indirectly through school-wide projects. I want to thank our volunteers, all the tables you saw tonight, getting tickets when you buy books later on after the reading and get books signed. Those are all run by volunteers. Let me thank the volunteers and the other staff at the Poetry Center. They do a lot of work. I want to thank those who make all of this possible. Especially, I want to thank the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, who sponsored this evening's event. The Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation's principal focus is to support the arts and arts organizations, cultural organizations like the Poetry Center and like all sorts of other organizations. The Poetry Center is in residence at the School of the Art Institute. We have been here for 21 years. Programming support comes from the Lannan Foundation, Target Stores, the Lewis R. Laurie Foundation, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, the Illinois Arts Council, the Chicago Community Trust, the Polk Brothers Foundation, the Fred and Susan Novy Family Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, Lynn and Alan Turner, the National Endowment for the Arts, Fund for Poetry, Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation again, Bank One Foundation, that's a new foundation for us, Chicago Community Trust Young Leaders Fund, the Steens Family Foundation, the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs, and then the Chicago Sun-Times, who donates books that we then, poetry books that we then give out to the Chicago Public Schools. I want to especially thank Can TV for being here this evening, the gentlemen with the cameras. They will record and then air this to their million-plus viewers. Okay, one last little commercial, and then we'll get on to the show. The Poetry Center has produced a limited edition broadside for every reading in the last couple years. We are in production of Lee Young's broadside right now. All of those broadsides will be on display at Bell Studio. There's a postcard in the back. It will be a exhibition of broadsides at Bell Studio during National Poetry Month in April. Tonight's event will consist of live poetry, a short question and answer session, and a book signing immediately after. By a twist of fate, I'm going to stay up on stage and not introduce anybody else, but introduce Lee Young myself. And it's a pleasure and an honor to do so. It's been 21 years since Lee Young Lee last graced the Poetry Center stage. And in the last 21 years, Lee Young has done what few poets have managed to do, to become popular with a large readership. And he has done it in his own way. He dropped out of the University of Arizona MFA program. He has a full-time job in a field unrelated to poetry. He does not hold a teaching post, and he very rarely teaches or conducts workshops. Since his 1982 reading at the Poetry Center, he's published three books of poetry, Rose, The City in Which I Love You, and Book of My Nights, all published by Boa Editions, as well as a lyrical memoir titled The Winged Seed, published by Simon & Schuster. Lee has won numerous awards and fellowships, including a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship and the Lamont Poetry Award for Poetry from the Academy of American Poets. While reading or listening to Lee Young Lee read his poetry, one can find a peculiar sphere of peace and stark beauty and conviction of his art in each piece. It's peculiar because the poetry tells you that it doesn't know, nor is it interested in becoming something that knows things completely. Paradoxically, this purposeful lack of knowing stems from a deep spiritual faith and conviction. The words grace and humility come to mind when I think of his work. Last night during a workshop, one of the few that he did one for the Poetry Center last night for 20 Illinois poets. Lee, I hope I'm not stealing your story, Lee Young, but he recounted an experience he had while visiting a Gothic cathedral. A little girl was looking up and saying, "Mommy, hold me, I'm falling up." Lee was struck by this phrase because there is never anything between us and the furthest reaches of space, but it takes an artist to point it out through structure that imitates infinity. Lee Young's poetry does exactly this. In it, there is a feeling of falling up, like gazing at a rural winter night sky or at the vaulted roof of a Gothic cathedral. Please welcome Lee Young Lee.
Thank you. Okay, how's that? Thank you, Ken, for that beautiful introduction. I hope it's true. I don't know. Anyway, and thank you all of you for coming. Thank the Poetry Center for making this possible, and all the powers that be. I'm going to read for about read and talk for maybe 45 minutes or so, and then I'll open up for questions or comments that you have. And if you feel shy, please feel free to write your question or whatever it is, insult or whatever, on a piece of paper and pass it up, and I'll read it. Let me see. We had a workshop last night, and a couple of the students asked for me to, if I could clarify some of the things we talked about and reiterate them, because I wasn't clear or something caught their ear. So I will go ahead and do that, maybe as a way of introduction into these poems. You know, I'm almost embarrassed to say this because as I hear myself saying what I'm about to say, I'm aware of the fact that I probably think too much about poetry. But I've been thinking about the nature of human speech, and it dawns on me that can you hear me, Ricky? Is this good? Okay. It dawns on me that all speech in English, I'll qualify that by saying in English, is done with the exhaled breath. I haven't studied like all the languages, so I can only say this about English, and maybe Chinese too, that speech is done with the exhaled breath. And if we pay attention to breathing, we notice that when we breathe in, our bodies are filled with nutrients, oxygen. There's scientific proof that our bones actually get compacted, harder, and our muscles get softer, firmer, more tone, when we inhale. So we could think of inhalation as the in-feeding breath. The body is fed. The mind feels very clear and comfortable. As we exhale, there's proof that the bones actually soften. Our muscles get softer. Nutrients are leaving the bloodstream. And if we exhale to completion, it feels kind of uncomfortable. You know, the mind kind of reels and starts to gasp for the inhalation. That could be thought of as the dying breath. Life is leaving the body. The beautiful but tragic quality of speech is that all speech is the dying breath figured. And if you're writing poems or if you're writing something as a score for human speech, the medium ultimately is the dying breath. And so you become, even if it's unconscious, you become aware somehow, even if it's only at a visceral level, that what you're engaging is your own dying. Does this make any sense? The wonderful part, of course, is that meaning gets revealed disclosed as we speak, so that the more we say, the more the meaning gets divulged. So that meaning grows in opposite ratio to vitality. Is this making sense? So as we breathe, and the vitality, you know, the more I speak, the more the breath, you have less and less breath, but you have more and more meaning. And it seems to me maybe tragic that we can't even make meaning in the world unless we expend the breath. There's another quality to this, these weird trajectories going on. I hope I'm not losing all of you. You okay with this? Is this too theoretical? Okay. If you begin with a blank sheet of paper, something like this, my own experience is a feeling of overabundance. The difficulty for me when I'm writing a poem, trying to write a poem, is that there are too many poems. I could write about anything. I could write about these balconies, that chandelier, somebody in the audience, your faces, hands, shoes, feet, this jacket, my voice, you know, the light. You could write about anything. So you begin in a condition of pure potential. That pure potential feels scary in a way. It feels like overabundance. And yet you try to negotiate that by making the poem. But the minute you start to write the poem, you close down. You go from a condition of pure potential to a condition of writing this specific poem. So you begin to exclude other potentials. Is that making sense? So you go from a state of, you know, fullness to a state of specificity and thisness, this particular utterance, as opposed to all possible utterances. So there again, there's a kind of closing down. The lovely thing, it seems to me, about poetry is that it enacts a kind of returning to the potential, you know, because it's written in lines. You keep obsessing so much about the potential that you keep bringing it back to the beginning. You start the line over. I hope this is making sense. So it seems to me that I think people write poems because one is so moved or anxiety-ridden about the dying breath that you try to ransom it by packing the outgoing breath with as much psychic, emotional, intellectual, erotic, spiritual, soulful content as possible. I think that accounts for the condition of poetry where, you know, you read a poem and there are manifold meanings and manifold references and myriad referentials and that kind of thing. I can't promise you're gonna hear anything like that tonight, but this is my attempt. So maybe these aren't even poems. I don't know. You know, maybe these aren't poems. Maybe they're just my way to deal with this sense of anxiety. I'll read you something that I was just working on this afternoon. I was so nervous about this reading. You know, I was having a conversation with myself, and I thought, all these people are going to discover you're not a poet at all, you know. So I said to myself, prove it, you know, write something interesting. And I'll read this. You know what, I won't. I'll start with something else. And if things are friendly, I'll read that. If they, if things get nasty, I'll... No, you people are so wonderful, so... far, and so it looks good. I'll start with a request. This is called My Father in Heaven is reading out loud. My Father in Heaven is reading out loud to himself Psalms or the news. Now he ponders what he's read. No, he is listening for the sound of children in the yard. Was that laughing or crying? So much depends upon the answer. for either he will go on reading or he'll run to save a child's day from grief. As it is in heaven, so it was on earth. Because my father walked the earth with a grave, determined rhythm, my shoulders ached from his gaze. Because my father's shoulders ached from the pulling of oars, my life now moves with a powerful back and forth rhythm. Nostalgia, speculation. Because he made me recite a book a month, I forget everything as soon as I read it. And knowledge never comes except when I'm mid-stride a flight of stairs or lost a moment on some avenue. A remarkable disappointment to him, I am like anyone who arrives late in the millennium and is unable to stay to the end of days. The world's beginnings are obscure to me, its outcomes inaccessible. I don't understand the source of starlight or starlight's destinations, and already another year slides out of balance. But I don't disparage scholars. My father was one, and I loved him, who packed his books once and all of our belongings, then sat down to wait instruction from his God, yes, but also from a radio. At the doorway, I watched, and I suddenly knew he was one like me, who got my learning under a lintel. He was one of the powerless to whom knowledge came while he sat among suitcases, boxes, old newspapers, string. He did not decide peace or war, home or exile. Escape by land or escape by sea. He waited merely, as always someone waits, far, near, here, hereafter, to find out, is it praise or lament, hidden in the next moment? I'll read you another poem about my father. When I was a kid, every morning I came downstairs and my father would be waiting for me and he would ask, have you prayed? And I would lie. I would say, yeah, you know. I lied to him all the time. Never felt guilty about it. I lied about everything, you know, going to school. You know, sometimes I would skip and I never felt guilty. And he's been dead 21 years. About a year ago, maybe a little over a year, I was sitting in a hotel room in Philadelphia, and I heard his voice as though he were standing right beside me. You know, have you prayed? I was just devastated. You know, I wanted to get on my knees. I wanted to apologize. I didn't know to whom I would apologize, you know. And so I wrote this, and I noticed that I was so overwrought with confused feelings, this thing that I wrote, it tries to set up a kind of intellectual understanding or something, and it keeps falling apart. And initially, I thought that that was terrible, and so I threw it away, but after a while, I thought, well, maybe that's okay. You know, maybe it works. I've read this to a couple friends, and some of them think it works better than some of the other ones. You can tell me what you think. If it's good, tell me. If it isn't, tell Ken Clark. He'll be the guy. Okay. This is called Have You Prayed? Have you prayed? When the wind turns and asks in my Father's voice, have you prayed? I know three things. One, I'm not finished answering to the dead. Two, a man is four winds and three fires. And the four winds are his father's voice, his mother's voice, or maybe he's seven winds and ten fires. And the fires are seeing, hearing, touching, dreaming, thinking. Or is he the breath of God? When the wind turns traveler and asks, in my Father's voice, have you prayed? I remember three things. One, a father's love is milk and sugar. Two-thirds worry, two-thirds grief, and what's left over is trimmed and leavened to make the bread the dead and the living share. And patience, that's to endure the terrible leavening and kneading. And wisdom, that's my father's face in sleep. When the wind asks, have you prayed? I know it's only me reminding myself a flower is one station between Earth's wish and Earth's rapture. And blood was fire, salt, and breath long before it quickened any wand or branch, any limb that woke speaking. It's just me in the gowns of the wind, or my father through me asking, have you found your refuge yet? Asking, are you happy? Funny, a troubled father, a happy son, the wind with a voice, and me without one. I'm going to read you this thing that I wrote, and this is the poem that's going to be on the broadside. I kept Ken Clark waiting forever with this thing. He called. It had glue on it. You know, I would fold it up and put it in the envelope, and I couldn't get my hand off of it. And I would pull it back out, and there were all these things wrong with it. You know, and I would work on it for another week. Then I would fold it up and put it back in, and so on. And so this was a very strange thing I wrote. I was, a friend was talking to me, and I started writing this. And I said, sorry, Tony, I have to just take a note down. So I kept writing, and he kept talking. So the words he said kept feeding into the poem, you know. At first I thought they were interruptions, but actually I looked, and this thing, it made me do things that I wouldn't have otherwise done. So this is called Every Circle Wider. Is this a good level, Ricky? Is this good? Every Circle Wider. Silver, the women sing of their bodies and the men. Darker, the men sing of their ancestors and the women. Darkest is the children's ambition to sing every circle wider. Dying, each sings at the edge of what he knows, pregnant with the unknown, that chasm, sustained trembling called singing, makes visible by overleaping. Criminal, my recalling that country's songs and never intending to go back. No word comes from there, but remembering is steam and engine. My voice filling and emptying as I sing. The world is full of people and no one at all. The world is full of hours and none of them are to be found. The world is full of rooms and no place to remain. The world is full of light, but no one's seen a thing. The world is all dark, yet a hand finds its way to other hands, a mouth its way to other mouths. Did that make it across? You know, I want to change a word here. So I'm going to read it again with the changed thing. Is that okay? Let me see how this sounds. I'm going to change one word here. Okay. Every circle wider. Silver. The women sing of their bodies and the men. Darker. The men sing of their ancestors and the women. Darkest is the children's ambition to sing every circle wider. Dying, each sings at the edge of what he knows, pregnant with the unknown, that chasm, sustained trembling, called singing, makes visible by overleaping. Criminal, my recalling that country's songs and never intending to go back. No word comes from there, but remembering is steam and engine. My voice filling and emptying as I sing. The world is full of people and no person at all. The world is full of time and none of it can be found. The world is full of rooms and no place to remain. The world is full of light, but no one's seen a thing. The world is all dark, yet a hand finds its way to other hands, a mouth its way to other mouths. I don't know, it sounded the same. It didn't make much difference. This is called First World. First World. Sister, we died in childhood, remember? Into birds we died, and they're flying. Toward all of sky we perished so completely. Our mother cried, "Where are my little ones?" Into her voice we died. That white singing dispersed in day's greater sentence. And the days, we disappeared into them and what they confided, coming and going. But where? Of noon we died, and of midnight, our heart's longings, the bridges we flung toward the future, hearts we wove in secret, out of worry, wonder, and expectancy. And we died of the future, of calling and mission only we could keep, leaping into faces, trees, toys, houses, seasons, sinking into roots, dreams, and books. Nights beyond the house, we looked up and fell into the known configurations of stars. Nights housed and in bed, we closed our eyes and died into the unknown constellations, the empty basket, the jeweled stare, the table set for a guest. Into our names we died, then passed their precincts. We who would not be persuaded, every world lay kept in other, bigger hands. We who were haunted by suspicions that where we stood, there stood all worlds. We died, and I've been sowing grass and flowers ever since. We died, and we go on dying. So where would I look for us, except in everything I see? I'll read a couple of things out of this book, Book of My Nights. I'll read you another request. I love getting requests. It makes me feel famous, you know. You know, it's kind of strange, though, because I notice, and this is not a complaint, but it's just something that I noticed, that the same poems get requested. It makes me feel happy, you know, because in a way, in a strange way, poems are kind of like your children. Not really, but, you know, you kind of think of them that way. And when the same poems get requested, you do feel that those are like favorite children, you know. But you start to worry about the other ones that don't get requested, right? Because you think, well, you know, aren't they pretty enough or aren't they smart enough? But then you're glad that these poems have, the ones that get asked to be heard, have a kind of life of their own, you know. So I'm happy about that. This is a birthday poem I wrote for my mother. I have a dear friend, a wonderful poet, and she said, I was explaining to her that I felt nervous about the fact that I was obsessed with my mother's body. And she said, it's okay. All writers are trying to recreate their mother's body in the poem or in the novel or something. I don't know, Rosalyn. You'll have to tell me if it's true for novels. But I hope it's true, you know, that I don't feel so bad. But there's a little story that goes with this. When I went to kindergarten, I went to kindergarten one day, and the second day when my mother woke me, my wife is in the audience, this is weird, my wife woke me, my mother woke me and said, it's time to go to school. And I said, I did that already. I did it yesterday, you know. And she explained to me that this is something you have to do all the time. And I refused. I was really, you know, stubborn and a mean little kid. And I said, no, I'm not going, you know. And she said, what if I carry you? And I said, will you carry me back? And she said, okay. So she carried me back and forth to kindergarten. This is true. And one day I had my face against her neck and I noticed she was running a fever and I asked her, I said, are you running a fever? She said, yeah, I don't feel so well. And I said, oh, put me down. And, you know, from that moment on, I walked to school. But, so this is a poem I wrote for her. This is called The Hammock. The Hammock. When I lay my head in my mother's lap, I think how day hides the stars. The way I lay hidden once, waiting inside my mother's singing to herself. And I remember how she carried me on her back between home and the kindergarten. Once each morning, and once each afternoon. I don't know what my mother's thinking. When my son lays his head in my lap, I wonder, do his father's kisses keep his father's worries from becoming his? I think, dear God, and remember, there are stars we haven't heard from yet. They have so far to arrive. Amen, I think. And I feel almost comforted. I've no idea what my child is thinking. Between two unknowns, I live my life. Between my mother's hopes, older than I am by coming before me, and my child's wishes, older than I am by outliving me. And what's it like? Is it a door and goodbye on either side? A window and eternity on either side? Yes, and a little singing between two great rests. Here's a poem I wrote for a brother I lost when I was very young. This is called Black Petal. Black Petal. I never claimed night fathered me. That was my dead brother talking in his sleep. I keep him under my pillow, a dear wish that colors my laughing and crying. I never said the wind, remembering nothing, leaves so many rooms unaccounted for, only continual farewell must ransom the unmistakable fragrance our human days afford. It was my brother, little candle in the pulpit, reading out loud to all of earth from the Book of Night. He died too young to learn his name. Now he answers to vacant boat, burning wing, my black petal. Ask him who his mother is. He'll declare the birds have eaten the path home. But each of us joins night's ongoing story wherever night overtakes him. The heart astonished to find belonging and thanks answering thanks. Ask if he's hungry or thirsty. He'll say he's the bread come to pass and draw you a map to the 12 secret hips of honey. Does anyone want to know the way to spring? He'll remind you the flower was never meant to survive the fruit's triumph. He says an apple's most secret cargo is the enduring odor of a human childhood, our mother's linen pressed and stored, our father's voice walking through the rooms. He says he's forgiven our sister for playing dead and making him cry those afternoons we were left alone in the house. And when clocks frighten me with their long hair, and when I spy the wind's numerous hands in the orchard unfastening first the petals from the buds, then the perfume from the flesh, my dead brother ministers to me. His voice weighs nothing but the far years between stars in their massive dying. And I grow quiet, hearing how many of both of our tomorrows lie waiting inside it to be born. I'll read you another thing from childhood. It reminds me of this poem. This is a weird poem. This next poem is it ends with the names of a bunch of flowers, but you shouldn't try to go look them up. There are no such flowers. I just made them up, you know. I was writing the poem. I feel nervous about calling it a poem. That's like an honorific or something. I was writing this thing, and I came to a place as I was writing that I didn't know what to do. So I thought, well, I'll just make up a bunch of names of flowers, you know. So I did, and so that's how this goes. This is called The Shortcut Home. The Shortcut Home. In my sister's story, my mother swears we were born, but God can't find us in any of his coat pockets, not in the empty and not in the filled. We're in none of his hands, the fine or the terrible, none of his shoes, the giant or the minute. And neither are we hiding inside his apples, neither in the perfect nor the ruined, not in the first mouthful and not in the last. In my brother's story, our death sings to us from the highest branch of the oldest tree the birds remember in song. And we wander our father's house in search of the origin of the hours. In my story, but I don't have a story. All I have are a few names of the flowers. Morning glory, 7 o'clock, mother of wings, dreaming undone, dreaming shouldered, story carried backward up a stairs. All I have is a sewn path I follow back to sleep. Painted face, clouded pain, song in a jar, burning threshold, bloody scrimmage, voice strewn on the rocks. Sometimes I think, like, writing is a kind of problem solving. You know, you set up problems. Robert Frost says you put yourself in legitimate danger in order to accomplish legitimate rescue. And so you put yourself in danger and you try to get yourself out of it by coming up with crazy stuff, you know. So I'll open up for questions now. And yes.
How much control do you feel you have over your inspiration?
That's a great question. You know, I tried to account for this, and I came to the conclusion that we talked a little bit about this in the workshop last night. I've been noticing that if we think about things, anything in the world, you know, like for instance this podium, if I think about how this podium got here, I would have to begin with the person who carried it in here, right? And I would have to begin with the person who made it. I mean, I have to go to the person who made it. Then I would have to go to the wood that this, you know, that, and so on, and the tree. And after a while, if you do it meticulously, if you try to follow the whole myriad network of circumstances, the mandala of circumstances that creates anything, the only conclusion you can reach, and the only sensible thing to say, is the whole universe conspires to make anything. So a poem, it seems to me, is a condition of everything writing the poem. You know, the ache in your knee, the headache or the lack of headache, the coffee you had, the coffee you didn't have, the leaf mold from, you know, picking up a leaf, the fresh air you got from taking a walk, the news story you just heard, you know, the sound of somebody closing a door outside. I mean, it seems to me that condition of allness, of everythingness, of cosmos is what writes the poem. So you can't even control whether you're or not you're open to that. So it isn't you. It isn't a specific you that wills the poem into being. Does that make sense? So I love that question. Yes. You mean in this historical moment? See, what's complicated for me There are wars going on all over the world all the time. For me, and I'm going to articulate this wrong, so please, you know, ask more questions if it feels insufficient. For me, to privilege a particular war at a particular time seems to me another one of ego's tricks, its obsession with its own time, its own thing, when in fact, what I'm concerned about and what troubles me is the wars going on all over the world. So even before this war, you see, and I know what we mean by this war, it seems to me that, you know, some people are troubled by war in general, killing in general. Do you know what I mean? It feels to me that to be specific that way, it seems. You know, I knew a person. I knew a very wonderful person who grew up during the Vietnam era. And we went to school together, and we talked a lot about the war, the Vietnam War, you know, when we were kids. And he said, "I don't care about that. I'm not going to war. Why should I care about that?" You know, I thought, "Oh, interesting," you know. Until his brother had to go. Then he got really kind of upset, you know. So it seems to me that that would be like saying, "I don't care about any of the wars going on in the world until the people I know have to go." But, you know this idea of 6 degrees of separation? So it seems to me they're within 6 chess moves, I'm connected to anybody in the world. You know, so it seems to me that my real concern, my anxiety, comes from human being itself. Do you know what I mean? And in terms of poetry, it seems to me that in terms of art, art safeguards, but maybe not, I don't know. It seems to me that art safeguards the image of the human being as precious in the cosmos. And maybe that's the most you can do, safeguard that image of the human being as precious. And when I say human being, I don't mean my human being, you know, or your human being. I mean everybody's human being. Does that make sense? Well, I don't know.